There's a great old story about a man who's been drafted into the army, and he doesn't want to serve. So wherever he went, he would stoop down and pick up every single piece of paper that he saw on the ground. And every time he picked up a piece of paper, he'd look at it, and he'd turn it over, and he'd stare at it, and he'd shake his head no, and he'd crumple it up, and he'd throw it away. Well, it didn't take long for his superior officers to become aware of this rather odd behavior. And they decided they needed to figure out what was the underlying cause of what this soldier was doing. So they tried and they tried and they followed him around. They picked up other papers after him and they read them and they couldn't figure it out. They finally figured out that he was a little bit crazy. So they had to discharge him. So they gave him a medical discharge. And the soldier was summoned into the office of his superior officer, and he was handed the discharge, which granted his release. And he picked it up, and he looked carefully at it, and he says, "This is it! This is what I've been looking for!" It made me think that, you know, many people are like that soldier. He's kind of going through life, looking around, waiting for this one big break that's going to turn their life around. That'll give them riches and fame and prosperity and power. And for some people, that break is thought to come from Wall Street. You know, one day they're going to open the paper and look at the Dow Jones average and say, that's it, I'm rich. I recently read that 17% of all Americans think they're going to win the lottery. They literally think that's their plan for riches, that they're going to win the lottery and become a millionaire. 17%, one out of every seven people. For others, that lucky break is expected to come from Hollywood or from Nashville, you know, because they think they can sing. Too many people think of their success as coming from some big, life-changing, momentous event. Like they're going to be able to look back and say, "I remember I was sitting there in that diner and then it hit me, and my life has never been the same since." I think it's very easy for us to misunderstand the story of Joseph by kind of superimposing that false conception of success on the experience Joseph had. You know, one day he's sitting there in jail, at the end of that day, he sleeps in the second best bed in town, you know, dressed in gold. He was exalted to the second highest position in all of Egypt. We may look at the dreams of Pharaoh and the mention of Joseph by the cupbearer as his lucky break. That was it. That was his lucky break. That was what changed Joseph's life, what broke the chain of frustrating turn of events that had previously plagued him. And when you read Joseph, you can look back upon past events and you can see their part and bringing Joseph to Pharaoh's palace. We can also look ahead and see the reason why God brought Joseph to his position of power. You see, Joseph's life story was no fairy tale. Moses didn't tell us that after Joseph was promoted by Pharaoh, he lived happily ever after. Joseph had been promoted for a definite purpose. And you can't overlook this and the joy of seeing him taken out of the pit and placed in position of power, you can't overlook the reason, the purpose of why he was placed there. The story of Joseph is a roller coaster of emotion. Consider yourself, just consider yourself in Joseph's shoes for a moment. First of all, you're born into an incredibly wealthy, large family. This is the equivalent of the Irvines in Orange County or the Newhalls up in Valencia. And you are clearly and declared to be the favorite son. But your brothers hate you. So you're taken out in the desert to be killed. But instead they sell you as a slave. But you become second in command to Potiphar's house. The person who buys you finds you so valuable that you be given this position of power, position of prestige. So you flourish in your new job, and everything you touch seems to turn to gold. But his wife comes on to you, and you get thrown in jail. And you befriend some of the slaves in jail, and you interpret their dreams, but when they're released, they forget all about you. And they don't remember you in your chains. You see the king go into this wild tear, and he has decided to kill all of his advisors. But then you are given the opportunity to interpret his dream. So imagine yourself at that point in Joseph's life. You've been through all those ups, all those downs. You're brought up out of the prison. Hurriedly. It's like, oh, everyone's going to die. Get him out of here. Get him up here. If he can help us, let's get him up here. You notice that he doesn't face Pharaoh until he had shaved and changed his clothes. He wasn't just cleaning up, which I'm sure he needed, having been in jail. But it was a cultural concession, too. To the Hebrews, a beard was a mark of dignity. But for the Egyptians, a beard was something very offensive. So Joseph takes the time to shave so as to not unnecessarily offend the king of Egypt. And when Joseph comes before Pharaoh, the distressing dreams of the previous night were immediately brought up. And Pharaoh had heard that Joseph could interpret him. What a opportune moment for Joseph to capitalize on. Very few times in your life you're put in a position of power. So imagine this. You're at work one day, and all of a sudden the four black Suburbans pull up out front, and the four guys in the black suit come in, and they talk to your manager, and they say, which one of these is Jelano? It's that one over there. And they come into your room, and they say, Mr. Obama needs you right now. And they put you in the Escalade, and they drive you down to the airport, and you get on the private jet, and 2.5 hours later, you're in D.C., and they rush you into the room, and you borrow someone's coat because you didn't have a coat that day, and they sit you in a room, and you sit down, and the president comes in, and he says, I need your help. You need to help me. Wow. Well, let's talk a bit about my taxes. Right? If I had been in Joseph's sandals, I think things would have gone a little bit differently. I would have likely have used this occasion to make a bargain with the king. Because where were you 4 hours ago? You were in jail. So, you know, yeah, I can probably help you out. I can take care of what you need. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, right? You know, I have a special on interpretations this week. One interpretation for get out of jail free card. Did you notice, though, as much as these things would have crossed Joseph's mind, he never brings the subject up. His first concern was not with his own comfort, but with God's glory. The ability to interpret dreams, which Pharaoh had credited to Joseph, was not his at all. Only God can interpret dreams, Joseph tells Pharaoh. So the first thing he says to Pharaoh is to correct him. No, you're wrong. The information you have is wrong. No, I can't interpret dreams. Only God can interpret dreams. So Joseph skillfully interprets the two dreams, and his interpretation closely followed the two dreams in many particulars, a fact which could hardly have been unnoticed by Pharaoh, and which added credibility to Joseph's explanation. The two dreams, while different in some details, were one in the same meaning. Both dreams were given in order to indicate the certainty of what was to occur. In each instance, 7 was the time involved, and it meant 7 years. The fat cows and the plump heads of grain were indicative of 7 years of abundance, which were to commence soon in Egypt. And the 7 gaunt cows and the 7 scorched and withered heads of grain foretold the famine, which was to follow 7 years of famine after 7 years of plenty. So the bottom line was that Egypt was to have 7 years of plenty followed by a famine so severe that all of the previous abundance would be consumed. Now, how easy it would have been to stop right there. That's the interpretation of the dream. There was good news and bad news. Abundance followed by famine. But Joseph goes one step further. Joseph was more than a prophet. He was an administrator. Not only was he able to foretell things to come, but he was also competent to analyze the situation and determine the best course of action to take to minimize its detrimental effects. And so a decisive plan of action was proposed by Joseph to Pharaoh, even though Pharaoh didn't ask for it, along with the predictions that were given. I've been thinking about this, and I'm convinced, knowing what I know about the character and the humble spirit of Joseph, that it never entered into his mind that he would be the one to be appointed to administer this project. He tells Pharaoh, here's what's going to happen. You're going to have 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. What you do is pretty simple. During those 7 years of plenty, you're probably going to have 3, 4, 5, 6 times your normal harvest. Take 20% of it and set it aside. You'll end up with, you know, 4, 5, 6, maybe 7 years worth of grain. And when the famine comes, you can use that. But he never thought that he would be the one to do that. Self-interest wasn't part of his character, his conduct. And you notice he doesn't even mention his unjust imprisonment, because he was one of the only people in jail who was innocent. He never touched Potiphar's wife. He never tried to rape her. But she unjustly accused him, and he's been squandering in jail ever since. And who could ever conceive that a Hebrew slave was going to be elected to the second most highest position in Egypt? Joseph never even imagined this would be his. But the proposal made sense to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to his servants, listen to this. Can we find a man like this? Where are we going to find a man like this in whom there's a divine spirit? Look what he does in verse 39. Since God has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. This is a 30-year-old Hebrew slave that has spent most of his entire adult life as a slave. Pharaoh says in verse 40, you shall be in charge of my palace, and all my people are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you. I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt. Pharaoh took his signet ring from his finger and put it on Joseph's finger. That's like his signature. At work, you sign important papers all day long. Pharaoh says, I'm not even going to sign any papers anymore. If anyone has any papers to sign that are important, they come to you. He took his signet ring and put it on Joseph's finger. He dressed him in robes of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. He had him ride in a chariot as his second in command. And men shouted, make way, here comes Joseph. Thus he put him in charge of the whole land of Egypt. And Pharaoh said to Joseph in verse 44, I am Pharaoh, but without your word, no one will lift a hand or a foot in all of Egypt. Now, if I had negotiated this deal, what would I have asked for? Get me out of jail. That's it. The best that Joseph could have dared to hope for was his release from jail. He told the cupbearer and the baker, he said, when you get out of here, remember me so I can be released from jail. That's what he hoped. When they were rushing him out of prison, when they were showering him and shaving his face and getting him ready to go see Pharaoh, that's what he hoped. Maybe this will result in me getting out of jail. How far beyond that was the elevation to a position of power and prestige? Without your word, no one in all of Egypt can lift a hand. That's one of the most awesome lessons for us to remember about how God works. That this is how God saves. God doesn't just barely get you by. God doesn't just barely squeak past. God saves you in great and glorious fashion. It's not like one day you're in jail and the next day you're out of jail, wandering around homeless with rags on. You're in jail, and that day, you're in the king's castle as the second in command, dressed in fine linen, wearing gold, having people say, "Make way, for here comes Joseph." So just as Joseph had indicated, the next 7 years were marked by great abundance. The land produced in such quantity that the grain held in reserve for future was beyond measure. They started counting it at first. You know, 100,000 pounds here, 100,000 pounds here. We got tons of this and tons of that. And then they were so busy just building new storehouses to stuff it in, they couldn't even count it. There weren't enough people. There weren't enough hours in the day to count the amount of food. So Joseph skillfully carries out the plan he had proposed to Pharaoh, storing up a fifth of all the grain in every city all across Egypt for later use. And at the end of 7 years of plenty, the famine hit with severity. People came to Joseph requesting bread. People came to Pharaoh requesting bread, and he sent him to Joseph, telling them to do whatever he said. Joseph opened up the storehouses and began to sell the grain to the Egyptians and to people from far lands, so that some of whom would end up being his brothers. So this little part of Joseph's life, this episode, brings us to a vantage point where you can kind of look backward and look forward. Looking back, you have to realize that Joseph's elevation is not the result of one lucky break. He didn't just one day all of a sudden be discovered. He didn't just one day, you know, make a lucky decision and succeed. Joseph's elevation was a chain of painful but divinely purposed events. It was a life full of ups and downs. Had Joseph not said no to Potiphar's wife and been unjustly cast in prison with the cupbearer, he would never have been recommended to the king. And had Joseph not been cruelly treated by his brothers and sold into slavery, he would never have been in Potiphar's house to begin with. If he hadn't gone through the bad things, then the good things would never have happened. So the next time you find yourself unjustly imprisoned, remember Joseph. The next time you find yourself having severe financial troubles, remember Joseph. Next time you find that you've lost a loved one, remember Joseph. When you find yourself publicly humiliated, remember Joseph. When you have a child that's sick and might not make it through, remember Joseph. And remember that this terrible event has happened to you as an integral part of how God works with those he loves. And remember Romans 8. God causes all things to work together for good to those who love him, to those who called according to his purpose.